Welcome to episode 168 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and we're joined today by my returning guest, Ilana Levin, the host of the Graphic Policy Radio podcast. Joining me from Brooklyn, Ilana, welcome back to Junk Filter.
I'm so excited to be here. I love your show, and I've realized I've made myself a nice little racket in being the person who comes on to explain to people why the music that they make fun of is smart, actually.
Our subject for today is ska music, and before you press stop on this episode, we're talking about the good stuff. There's going to be no mozzarella sticks on this show. We're talking about second wave ska, the musical movement that heralded a cultural shift in sound in the late 70s in the UK.
This is political music that is a joy and a pleasure to listen to, and that has impacted the world and has brought people together, and I think is, again, a template for one of the most successful pop cultural interventions that we've seen.
I should provide some context for the listener. Somebody put down ska music as the sound of what plays in a 13-year-old kid's head when he gets extra mozzarella sticks.
And I'm like, yeah, that's definitely what's happening when people are singing about poverty in, like, you know, destitution in Kingston. Oh, I'm sorry, you weren't aware of that. Okay, well, ska music is essentially, a part of it is protest and, like, refusing to, you know, acquiesce to being subjugated. So I don't know. That sounds pretty serious, actually. I destroyed the mozzarella meme on Twitter by responding to it, by explaining to people the significance of the works of Desmond Dekker. So, like, literally the original poster was like, I'm taking this down now. I'm like, okay, well, I'm a little bit sad that it's gone for posterity, because I do think I did a little bit of an introductory job educating people about Jamaican ska music in that initial, let's call it, conversation on Twitter. But yeah, I person who gets angry about needing to explain to ska to people is kind of my brand, I've realized. And that's fine, you know? I do want to caveat a number of things, which is that I am American, and the music that we're talking about is initially quintessentially Jamaican, and then becomes quintessentially British, and I'm American. And so I don't purport to be an expert at it in the way that someone who is, like, from that culture could be. But since most Americans know literally nothing about ska, I do stand before you prepared to educate. And this is definitely music that has meant a lot to me, and that I got into at a relatively young age. And while I'm not entirely certain how I first found out about second wave ska, I do know that literally the first thing I ever Googled on Al Gore's internet was looking up to see if Moon Ska Records still had an open office in New York City. I've really come around to respect, you know, the ska of my own youth in the 90s as being more legitimate than I might have wanted to dismiss it, to differentiate myself from it. That urge to say, well, what I like is serious and good, and therefore this thing that isn't my focus is stupid. And I'm like, well, it's not as much for me because it's too 90s, but it's not necessarily bad. Most people in America literally don't know what ska, second wave ska, is, or third wave ska. Sorry, or first wave ska. And their notion of third wave, like, maybe they're aware of, no doubt, maybe. And probably they're talking about the Aquabats or the Mighty Bosstones, or not even. So I just, you know, maybe know what things are before you talk shit is all, you know? And it's interesting because if you're in England, we would not be having this conversation. One of the things that interested me in talking with you is that you're Canadian and you have a different relationship to British popular culture than Americans do. And for me, it was definitely something I had to seek out and felt like something that most Americans did not know. And, like, we were really cool for knowing it. Now, I came of age during the time where third wave ska was becoming cool, but before No Doubt was anything that anybody had heard of in the East Coast. So, like, my high school had a ska band, which, were, like, kind of dicks to me because, or I should just say, didn't seem to be open to my proposal that I should play with them. which is consistent with lots of people's behavior in high school. Let's be real. But I think the fact that this was even a thing that existed, I grew up in a relatively pop culture savvy, you know, this is all pre-internet really, but like people, like I lived near a big city. So like people could go into town and see bands and see shows. It was not like popular culture found us a lot. We found popular culture more easily than folks in the hinterlands might, for example. But that was very much just, it was still like an underground thing, like the punk scene. And I saw a lot of what I think is a lot of the American interest in ska music came from the fact that we had a type of punk that could be played using band instruments that you had because you were a suburban middle-class kid who was in band class. And I also think that's part of why people in the US think a little bit down on it, because they're like, oh, it's band people. It's school band people, which might not be the most flattering stereotype here of the various cast of characters that populate our high schools. But you know, one of the reasons I delayed, when Terry Hall died last year, I was like, oh, we really have to do this. I have to get over my paranoia about not knowing every single thing in the world and just do this show. But one of the things that delayed it for me was I wanted to understand a better picture of the financial aspects of what made ska possible in the UK in that time period. And I don't just mean the fact that, like, you know, the UK has a different relationship to having, you know, basic needs met, even yeah. under Thatcher, than America. But I meant more like, yeah, brass instruments cost a fucking fortune. Where are you getting them from? Or in the case of ska bands, you're looking at very large bands. The economics of having a band with 7 and 8 members, how do you even fucking do that? It's really quite different from, you know, being a power trio. So there's a lot of interesting questions on that there. And so I was very interested in like, how are these working class British kids getting their hands on thousands of dollar brass equipment, you know? But then it even brought it up. Yeah, but how did people in Jamaica get it? Like people like in abject poverty. And so I really wish that I had, you know, I literally watched, there is, I didn't know until I was doing my research for this, a Madness biopic starring yes. Madness made in like 1982. It's very bad, but I enjoyed it greatly. I'm like watching this. I'm like, so where will I find out? How did their saxophone player, who's excellent actually, get a fucking saxophone, you know? And I've interviewed British people. They're like, well, yeah, people get instruments passed down to them from their parents. There is a longstanding tradition of working men's clubs in the UK having jazz bands. And, you know, so maybe there's some instruments in the pawn shop from those sort of pathways. But that always does fascinate me because the price points, they matter. And there's also a technology aspect where you have, you know, one of the sounds that's so iconic in the specials is the particular kind of Yamaha that the man who put the specials together, Jerry Dahmers, plays, which is not the electric keyboard that most rock bands or most bands playing Jamaican music were playing. He was playing a keyboard that is basically used to play lounge music. And it's one of the kind of thing where once you know that, you're like, oh yeah, that does make sense.
Ilana, you and I come to this topic from two different generations. We're both on the outside of it, but I'm a little bit older than you are. You found out about this music in the 90s from within the third wave. You started looking back and discovering the second wave, whereas mm-hmm. I was in high school in the 80s. And although the movement had ended by the time that I was a teenager, and my teenage years, a lot of these people were in their follow-up bands. And I knew about this music, though, not so much because of the radio or because certain music sent me there. I found out about it because the subcultures in my high school were so heavily influenced by ska and punk. You know, we had punk kids in my school. We had mods in my school. And I went to an alternative school, so we had a lounge where kids could just play whatever music they wanted, and that's how I found out about a lot of this music. Canadians had a slightly different take on second wave ska because of how influential British culture still was on Canada in the time before MTV and before the American pop influence really overwhelmed Canadians. for instance, in the Beatles hit in Canada before they hit in the United States, just because, you know, so many people who are Canadian still spoke with British accents and had British relatives. And the CBC radio was so heavily modeled on the BBC. So whatever the BBC was interested in, we were sort of interested in. Our alternative radio stations were heavily influenced by British radio. I think we were a little bit more on board with punk and new wave and ska from the UK. I think that we found that stuff before Americans did.
Oh, surely, yes. Part of the challenge was that Chrysalis was the parent label of Two Tone, was in charge of marketing ska in America, and they, speaking of the not taking things seriously, really played up the humor angle rather than any of the sort of culturally specific politics. And I feel like that might have had something to do with some of the reputation here as well. But there was an underground scene, you know, kind of the comparison I would draw is sort of famously, like, Black Flag is considered a band that kind of helped seed punk, hardcore punk throughout America, because they would tour the country and they'd always have local acts opening for them. My understanding is through a decent chunk of the 80s, Bad Manners, of all people, continued to tour in early 90s. Bad Manners continue to tour America and have local bands open for them, and that they to an actually helped seed the American revival of ska. Not anything having to do with No Doubt.
In watching these films and becoming familiar with bands that I didn't really have an image of what they were like The Selector, which was a group that was fronted by a woman.
Still is.
But I thought, that's where Gwen Stefani comes from. That's like, she even looks like her a little bit, like in terms of wearing the hat and being the, you know, the whirling dervish on stage and, you know, surrounded by dudes holding her own in a very male world. Wow, I'm positive that Gwen Stefani was like, I want to be like her.
Pauline Black definitely gets one of those most interesting person in the world awards. She was the only Black person in her town because she was adopted. And she goes to college. She wants to do folk music because that's like what will make a difference. And when she ends up seeing a ska show, she's like, actually, no, that's what I need to do. And she basically pitched herself to the Not Yet Selector. And they were like, fuck yeah, you can sing. So you're doing this. And so she goes on. They make an amazing debut album, an interesting and complex follow-up album. And then things sort of fizzle apart. But she ends up working in theater a lot. And she has an OBE now. And her two most recent albums are really good. And I would say a few of the songs on the 2017 album they did are like, it's as good as anything the Selector ever did. I can't, like, the album is Daylight, and the lead song Daylight is astonishingly good. I can't think of another band who has a song that good that many years from its debut in 1979. Mm-hmm. That's like my lifespan. I'm like, holy fuck. But she's just truly fascinating. I mean, and she was saying she got into ska because there was like skinheads, like the, you know, wow, now I have to explain that the British early skinheads were not racist, but the working class white kids, working class kids subculture were playing ska records in her school. And she was like, there's Black singers on this and I haven't heard them yet. What is this? Because she was so separated and isolated from Black culture because of her family. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of how she first developed an interest in it. But she's just an amazing person.
In one of the documentaries that I watched to get ready for this, there was an anecdote from the guitarist Neil Davies. When they performed On My Radio on Top of the Pops, he knew that she was going to be the center of attention. In the chorus, they go back and forth between the guitarists and her. Mm-hmm. He decided that for television, he would stand next to the other guitarist, Compton Manor, so that when they cut back and forth between Pauline and the guitar players, it would send out the subtle symbol of black and white musicians performing in unison.
Yes.
And also men and women performing in unison. That would be a powerful image to be on television.
Yep.
In a time where the UK was a really grim place to be with the rise of Margaret Thatcher and the tolerance for racists to have marches in the street. And one of the important things about so many of these bands was that they were a rebuke to that kind of direction that England was taking.
Yeah, it was this, like, ska was created as a political project. And I really believe it's one of the most successful social interventions in popular culture through the form of music that I can think of. And while, you know, yeah, like listening to ska music didn't cure England of racism. And in fact, to an extent, part of the reason the scene collapsed was that there were too many like National Front dickheads coming to shows and starting fights. Mm-hmm. It did impact the larger and less extreme part of the audience to hear these songs, to see these faces, to recognize themselves on television, to raise some of these questions. And I know we'll be talking about Fried Nelson Mandela in a little bit, but that had a real market impact. But yeah, it was all very deliberate from the start, part of the purpose of this genre. Some of the people who were early proponents of ska were felt like that the politics had been pulled out of punk too much. And then others said that because of the abrasive sound of punk, they didn't feel like it would be as effective insinuating politics into the general public's mind. And so it was makes something danceable and pleasurable and fun and very accessible. And then give it I don't want to say radical, but politics that are good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anti-racist politics.
Yeah. And a utopian idea of cooperation between races in a racist country.
Yeah. Really modeling that, showing people that what it looks like to have men and women, black people, white people, playing together.
Yeah. Because it's one thing to be saying these things. It's another thing to be putting it into practice and showing that it's easy as well. Like, or they make it look easy anyway, you know,
And they really championed like the Body Snatchers, you know, were an all female ska band, and they had played like two shows before the folks from like the more established two tone bands were like, we are bringing you under our wing and we were going to help you like do this and help you make it. And unfortunately the Body Snatchers only lasted for 1 year. What a pressure cooker of intensity, including the fact that some of the members had not touched instruments prior to forming the band. What a pressure cooker intensity that was to create that. That also represented huge ranges in different social class. Like one of the members' dad was like a lord, and then the others were from like council flats. So like it was all over the map. Then they found each other through an ad and Melody Maker. Nikki Summer was like, I'm looking for rude girls to join my band. And those were just the women who responded. It is sort of the shared calling, but not rooted from, you know, knowing each other from around the neighborhood or whatever, which is very much the opposite, where you have like Madness, who like literally, I think, were from the same council flat, you know, which is probably how they ended up being the all white band.
Let's set the table a little bit for what we're talking about here. I think we might want to take a few minutes to sort of define some terms that we'll be using during this show. So first of all, let's explain to the listener about the basic three waves of ska.
Ska is the first kind of Jamaican popular music to become popular outside of Jamaica. There were earlier forms that like Mento, which, as Andrew Hickey from A History of Rock and Roll in 500 Songs has attested, you can't really find any records of it to even listen to, that he's found that much. I don't know. But ska was really like Jamaicans listening to a lot of New Orleans-based American rock and roll, like Louis Jordan, Fats Domino, and developing their own like Jamaican version of that music. And they actually had a few breakthrough hits in the UK And there was a brief moment in the 60s of real ska influence in music beyond Jamaica, where like the Beatles song Taxman is a ska song.
Yes.
Like that is the rhythm that they're doing. The song My Boy Lollipop by Millie Small was like a huge hit there. And it just broke through. And then there were a number of other crossover hits over time, but as well as like, look, you had a massive increase of immigrants from Jamaica to the UK in the 60s and 50s is called the Windrush generation. And when you have a large number of people coming from one place to another, they're going to bring culture and music with them. And it very much, you know, like brought something to the UK that they needed. It was also in some ways seems like the first really like the first black music in England that wasn't from America in a significant way. And which meant that rather than UK bands just copying from an American form, like soul or R&B, there was black music from black people that weren't American. And that's part of what I think why, you know, and while there's certainly Jamaican people, I live in New York, plenty of Jamaican people in America, not at the same level of intensity and ratio as a cultural force as what you have in England. The overwhelming majority of first wave ska is made in Jamaica. It is made for a Jamaican audience. Definitely were some crossover hits. Trojan Records was set up in the UK basically to begin importing and producing local versions of Jamaican music, and you know, kind of became the home base for ska and for reggae, rocksteady, all the other sort of Jamaican forms of like how they were going to be distributed and sold in the UK. And there was a continuing relationship of, you know, artists coming to the UK and then going back to Jamaica, like recording, touring, coming back and forth, a lot of cultural exchange happening in that time space.
The other thing that's so important to stress about the wave of Jamaican families moving to the UK to enter the labor market, these were also people who, as part of the Commonwealth, had contribute to the war effort. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There were no laws against members of the Commonwealth arriving and applying for the right to work. And mm-hmm. Even if the British government wasn't thrilled about it, this is the consequence of colonial empire.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You destroy someone's life. Sorry, they might decide to move where you are. And, you know, one of the things I love is that Millie Small's comeback album in like 72 was a song about Enoch Powell sucks.
Yes.
I love you. That's amazing. Like you're doing, you know, a charming bubblegum song that breaks Jamaican music into the UK market in the 60s. And then 72, your entire song is like, Enoch Powell is evil. We'll bring him down. But it's all very up-tempo because it's ska.
And Coventry, the city in the Midlands, which was the birthplace of the second wave of ska, this was a major city for West Indians to settle in because of the auto manufacturing industry.
Yeah.
Skilled work was available with good wages. And also, you know, jobs were available after World War II because of the casualties, you know.
Yeah.
So people started, you know, they found work and they found good work as well. West Indians found work for the British Rail and in the NHS in construction. These were like solid opportunities. And as England started to sort of go through its own economic malaise and people started being out of work and looking for people to blame, that's when the mm-hmm. country got a little bit more racist and a little bit more desperate. And
yeah.
What is so valuable about the second wave ska scene is that it was putting into practice the idea of people living together and cooperation.
Yeah.
Even if the environment that they were in was an oppressive environment, and even if some of the kids that would come to see the shows didn't like black people very much.
A lot of folks feel like, you know, this happened in Coventry specifically for a reason, because it had that particular combination of factors. Now, there were ska bands coming from other places, you know, specifically, I would say, like, you know, the English beat, as we call it in America, because of copyright reasons, or the beat, as they're called, literally everywhere else, you know, from Birmingham, and Bad Manners is from London, but like the initial bands are from Coventry, and Coventry is very much like regards this as like the local music form now. They have a two-tone village that you can go and visit and like look at the two-tone Hall of Fame on the wall. And I'd love to do that someday. That would be amazing. And, you know, there had been a audience for ska in the UK beyond just the Jamaican communities. That was the vast majority of the audience. But there were white working class people who had found their way into these records and really loved them and built sort of a bit of a subculture around them. One of the things that's crazy is that you had literally top selling albums in the UK that were ska records before the BBC would even play ska on the radio or Jamaican records in general. Like, like you would be like a top 10 album and you would not hear it on the radio because the radio, because the BBC was that racist.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy. Well, let's talk a little bit too about the various subcultures of youth culture at this point. Man. Like, you know, the word skinhead has been destroyed in the preceding decades. It wasn't necessarily a bad word at the beginning.
No, it was a good word. If you watch any kind of interviews with original ska musicians from Jamaica, like they still predominantly use it in the original sense to talk about the British working class fans of early ska music, because people were very much like copying the styles of the Jamaican Rude Boys, which is their own sort of like gangster, badass, like cool, like that, like a Rude Boy is like a cool, badass guy with a bit of a gangster assumption, but doesn't have to be. And they were, you know, British guys like emulating that particular look and style. And so if you were, and so you had, you know, white working class people who were looking for a music subculture that was distinct from what was happening with the hippies, basically, like this was it. They found hippie culture very alienating and they loved this Jamaican music. And so, and they supported these artists. So like that was the first, you know, sort of the early skinheads in the UK. It wasn't racist. It was white people supporting black artists, like almost exclusively. It's very sad how that changed.
And the other thing that's worth mentioning is how important style and dress is to the scene. Their flashy attire, they dressed very well. It was a sign of, you know, gangster authenticity to be dressed well.
Yeah.
Also, James Bond was a huge influence on how people wanted to look. One of my favorite songs from the first wave of ska is 007 Shantytown by Desmond Decker.
Oh, so good. Fucking killer.
Which fucking mentions killer. James Bond and Ocean's 11. Yep. You know, it's like, that's like the height of sophisticated male style of the period.
Like, ska loves movies, and there are tons of movie themes covered by ska bands, both Jamaican and British. Like, the cover of the Skatalites cover of Guns of Navarone is like,
I love it.
The fucking killer. Like, it's so good.
And there are many really amazing James Bond ska songs, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. It's just people loved to play the theme songs of television and movie shows. Yeah, like there was, you know, a lot of discrimination. Like there'd be signs at clubs that would say no punks, no Rastas. And I think it's interesting to put how those two things were put together, which we'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. But yeah, like you had, you know, the British mod subculture, which was very interested in, initially would like to characterize itself as listening to a lot of modern jazz, but in reality was also very much listening to a lot of soul music imported from America. And had always very much had an appreciation for dressing in really good suits, even if you couldn't afford it. And a lot of that fashion sort of carried over as well. I don't think it's a coincidence that the UK had just had, you know, like Quadrophenia by The Who and then The Jam be so popular and then have Second Wave really blow up. These were not the same scenes, but I could like point to all these differences, but it's not like, you know, apples and oranges. It's more like an apple and a pear, even if the apple and the pear might decide to fight each other in the street for no apparent reason.
Right. And there's something a bit dandyish about it too. Like that, you know, these people wanted to look good all the time. That was very, very important. And in a sort of almost a primping and preening kind of way, you had to,
if you dress
a certain way. It was almost like there was a dress code. A very strict dress code.
Yes. If you're being dehumanized by day, then like trying to assert your individuality and taste in the other spaces makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is the way that changed in Second Wave for ska specifically. ska stylistically situated itself to be extremely accessible to people because you could literally just order a badge, as they call them in, I believe, your country, but certainly in the UK, and affix it to your jacket, and like that would count. Yeah. You could just wear black and white. And, you know, the bands were saying, like, we'd go to shows any place and you would just see everybody in the crowd. The second time we'd come through, we'd be all dressed in black and white. Like, most people can figure out a way to be dressed in black and white, regardless of what their existing wardrobe is. Additionally, the sort of suits that you would need to wear if you were going to really go for it to evoke the style, those were all in thrift stores at the time, mm-hmm. or your dad had one. So you didn't have to go and buy, like,
You didn't have to go to Savile Row or anything.
No, exactly. And also, if you look at people, you can tell those aren't Savile Row suits.
Yes.
I mean, in the ska scene, I would not say that about a mod. No, no, no. But ska has that punk element to it about the DIY. And so it was very deliberate to find a way to create a look for themselves that other people would have access to. And like the initial get-togethers of, for example, the Specials, they did not have a look solidified. Jerry Dahmers was like, I think we need to have a look. And he like drew a cartoon of like, here's the kind of things I think we should wear. You know, and a graphic designer worked with him on developing the logo for Two Tone, which is like based on a cartoon of Peter Tosh from the original ska movement. And, you know, the English Beat had an amazing logo design, who turns out that the woman in the Beat logo was Brigitte Bond, who was a trans woman singer and cabaret artist, who was like an amazing person. And you should go, I'll go watch this very short 30-minute documentary about her life. But, you know, but they were really interested in building this iconography that anyone could kind of buy and access. And not really policing it, which is funny because I remember when I first got into this stuff, I was very anal retentive about like, okay, but is that too A-line or do we need to talk more column skirt? And I'm like, yeah, if you look at the videos, like I don't actually think that anybody in the bands even cared at that level of detail, but it gave you a lot to play with. And certainly people like Pauline Black and Rhoda Dakar from the Body Snatchers and then from the Special AKA, like, had this really great fashion sense and were like trendsetters. And like, you know, Rhoda has this like amazing beehive with her natural hair. Like, rather than like doing the like, I will straighten my naturally kinky, you know, black textured hair into a beehive, she's like, no, I'm making a beehive with my hair as it is. And it was like amazing. And I can just imagine like if you were into 60s retro stuff and you've been like trying to iron your hair for forever, like how painful and hard that is, like seeing her being like, I can be 60s retro and also like not fight my natural hair texture, you know, and like that's incredible, actually.
But this segues to something that I wanted to ask you about, which is the participation of women in this scene. It feels to me like the idea of the rude boy and rude girl is one of the only areas where women were encouraged to have a style. You know, like I don't think of teddy girls like I do of teddy boys.
Oh, so many photos of teddy girls, though, and they all look like lesbians, and I think a lot of them were. So definitely. definitely a lot of British subcultural styles were a little bit more like men have to dress like this and women can kind of like do whatever. We don't really care about them actually, which is fascinating in some ways. But, you know, I think because there were so many prominent women in ska music and the artists, like the male artists, like wanted that and saw that as good, right? Like, again, like they were like nurturing and supporting the Body Snatchers who were brand new. And you could have totally been like, can you imagine all like the emo guys who might have tried to gatekeep out, you know, the women in that exact position, mm-hmm. you know, at some point in the early 00s. No, they were like, I love that you guys want to do this. Like, we're going to help you make this happen, you know? But you can see, like, looking at the group, like for the Body Snatchers, which presents the largest number of women on one space, that there's really a diversity of style and there's lots of tomboyishness mixed in with hyper feminine. You can kind of go in either direction. Interestingly, one of Nikki Summer from the Body Snatchers wrote that like when she was appearing on one of the things they were going to appear on television, the network was like, how come you're wearing pants? And she's like, cause I fucking want to. So they still were dealing with that kind of pressure to have to girl it up. But that was not being told, but Two Tone Records was certainly not telling them that.
No.
And the crowds were really mixed. I mean, if you look at them, now they were not, the crowds were never as black as you'd like them to be from what I've seen from the footage and from what Pauline Black herself said. And she, it sounds like one of the reasons that she kind of moved away from the scene is that it was frustrating to her that she didn't have a more black audience. She wanted to be creating music that was speaking to more of a black audience, but it certainly was not a segregated audience. It's just sort of a question of like, is this more white people than black people? Yes. Are there black people though? Yes, there are black people. Mm-hmm. You know,
but there might also be subcultures in the room that would like to kill each other in any other environment.
Yes, there
but
might
maybe
have been,
not, at a, not at a show.
And there might have also been, you know, black fans who would have loved to have gone and felt like they couldn't go to a show safely. Linval Goldie from Specials got stabbed, like coming from one of the Specials gigs. He got stabbed, like he was fucked up really bad, you know. So there was really a lot of danger and violence from fascists.
Some of the subcultures sort of splintered off into racist versions of those things, like some of the Teddy Boys were racists and formed gangs, as did skinheads. In fact, the word skinhead got corrupted over time being a shorthand for a sort of scary, violent, racist person.
And meaning something specific with their own specific musical orientation, you know, that was a form of punk in America. Like, yeah. Which, again, is not to say that we didn't also have skinheads against racial prejudice, but there's a reason why there had to be skinheads against racial prejudice in the first place, which was that there were skinheads who were for racial prejudice and that that had kind of become the norm.
Ilana, can you explain for the listener what ska is as its own musical genre form? I've always thought of ska as being an upside down rhythm and blues, that the emphasis on the backbeat is reversed.
Well, that's an interesting way to think about it. I mean, there literally is, like, if you go and you go on Wikipedia, it will play you the rhythm samples of the differences between a ska rhythm and the reggae beat and different kinds of shuffles, etc. I would say that to the best of our understanding, one of the reasons ska is called ska is because one of the early producers was trying to get the bands to sound more like what it is that we call ska. And he was telling the guitarist, no, I wanted it to sound more like ska, 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 ska. And like, that was like the rhythm he was telling them to get. And they're like, yeah, we'll play that ska music. Fine. You know, because like literally like some of these guys running the labels were gangsters. So they're like, sure, buddy, if you want that, we'll play it. Really don't want to get shot. So it had that particular syncopation to the rhythm. It also sort of sounds like you're pulling up on the chord rather than going down on the chord. And so the rhythm is so specific, like it just is distinct. And it's a different, it's much more up tempo and fast than reggae. Reggae is a lot more chilled out, and they both have that kind of like, it also has a shuffle, but it's a very different tempo to it. Now people can fight all day over like the exact boundaries between ska and reggae. And like, if you want to look up, you know, a song that I think is one of the most important songs of the 20th century, The Israelites by Desmond Dekker, you will see people who will call this a early reggae song and other people who will call it a late ska song. Like, there's not like, there's like a, you know, before the, you know, it's not like a hard whatever, but, you know, a general contour that you could offer would be with reggae being slower, reggae tending towards organ and electric piano, ska tending towards horn sections and being fast-paced. So yeah, you can hear all those different elements that make up their music. But we actually have information on how they developed the specific ska sound and why they chose ska. So early in the punk movement in the UK, in between band sets, before there was really much that they recognized as punk music on record, shows used to play reggae albums in between punk band sets. You know, I think that a lot of the attitude and politics really, and the rebellion, you know, really resonated with people. And so the Specials, when they began, thought like, you know what, we love reggae, we love punk, we're going to play reggae songs and we're going to play punk songs. And they would play a punk song, then they'd play a reggae song, then they'd play a punk song. And they really felt like, you know, this isn't sounding like a band, this is sounding like two bands. It isn't really coming together. And one day, Jerry Dahmer shows up at a rehearsal and he throws down a Prince Buster record and says, guys, I found the solution. We're going to play ska. And puts on the ska record. And ska music is more up-tempo. And that combination of the more up-tempo energy, that is something we can do while playing punk. And that was the idea for ska, was that they could play this up-tempo form of Jamaican music simultaneously while doing punk, and it integrated better and it combined together. And combining that with other vocal styles, a lot of that is done in conjunction with more traditional singing or punk vocals. Or, I mean, if you're, there's only one Terry Hall, and only Terry Hall sounds like Terry Hall. So that combination is so unique and magical.
Well, speaking of Terry Hall, I want to veer our conversation over to talk about my favorite band from this whole period, which is The Specials. A band that I feel should get a lot more respect than they do. As much respect as they get, like, I consider them one of the most important bands in British music history.
Yeah. I you know, The Specials, really an amazing treasure of a quote that I dug out was from Roddy Radiation, who's their guitarist, and he's describing in an interview, and he said this in a few places, you know, what it was that created the band's sound. And he says, Linval thought it was a ska band. Brian thought it was Tamla Motown. Neville thought he was U-Roy. Horace thought he was in a funky type of Little Feet band. I thought I was in The Clash. Jerry thought he was in an avant-garde jazz group. And Terry thought he was in The Cure. Yeah. How fantastic is that? That really does say it all. Because I think when I first heard ska, I don't know that I heard enough of those pieces of those other influences to truly see those other things in it. But it is all there. It is not just putting a ska beat to a punk song or putting a punk aesthetic to a Jamaican ska song. There's a lot of other stylistic influences that are coming together in the sound, and also that varies from between the different bands.
The pleasures that I had when I started discovering the music of The Specials was I recognize all those influences, like the lounge sound, the ska sound, the punk sound. And then I discovered that all that music on their first record was produced by Elvis Costello, which is another musician that I respond very strongly to.
It's truly an outstanding debut album. There are very few songs on it that aren't excellent. There are a few, but there are very few songs on it that aren't excellent. And that's really quite astonishing, especially given how quickly they were going from just being formed to recording. The time frame of all of this is insane. And The Specials were very much a constructed band. Founder of Two Tone, founder of The Specials, Jerry Dahmer's, like, had a vision. He says, I want to have a band that is diverse and specifically will have Black and white people playing together. And I'm going to go out of my way to recruit towards that end. So, you know, the band is not like, oh, we're all kids who grew up together. Like, no. You know, he went to college with Horace, and I think everyone else he, like, specifically recruited to join the band. Terry had been in, quote unquote, the only punk band in Coventry. And, like, Jerry was like, basically was like, you have to quit your band. You have to join mine. I know you think what you're doing is good, but we're going to do something really important. And he had to, like, basically, like, drag Terry away from being the lead singer of the only punk band in Coventry. And, you know, like, going into, like, the ska, you know, the reggae and, like, Jamaican spaces and, like, recruiting artists from there. So, yeah, like, it's a dynamic where you have people who don't even know each other, really, prior to recording together. And then they bring in Rico, like, absolute legend. Like, this guy is, Rico Rodriguez is, like, playing on original ska albums from the first wave. and he gets called into the studio to play a trombone solo on the first recording. And Rico is like, yeah, this shit's good. I'd like to play with you. And they're like, you do? Hooray. Because like, it's like, you know, you're, it's like if you're the Jam and the Who says, yes, I would, and somebody from the Who wants to join your band, basically. Right.
And I want to read for you a tweet that Billy Bragg wrote after the passing of Terry Hall in December of 2022. He said, the specials were a celebration of how British culture was invigorated by Caribbean immigration, but the onstage demeanor of their lead singer was a reminder that they were in the serious business of challenging our perception of who we were in the late 1970s. R.I.P. Terry Hall.
Yeah, that's so real. There was something so uniquely deadpan in his delivery. It's almost bizarre how much you should smile for the camera, like got directed at him, a man,
yeah,
of all people. But his sort of dour delivery and the sort of, he's so droll, and he has a way of singing a line that is the sing of someone who actually understands key and tempo in a real way. And it's such a contrast with the band's other two vocalists that it has this crazy energy. I mean, there's a reason that, like, you know, when he left, it was him and the two other vocalists from the band who left to do Fun Boy 3, because it's like, no, the three of our voices together are doing something really interesting. But I think, like, Terry's voice is a voice that could not be confused with anybody else's. But, you know, when Terry tells you, that when Terry Hall delivers the lyrics, is this the in place to be? What am I doing here? Watching the girls go by, spending money on beer, is like, it's just a taking everything down. Every single lyric from Nightclub could not be delivered by anybody but Terry Hall the way he does it. It's just, and you're sending it to your audience. Like, I won't dance in a club like this. All the girls are slags and the beer tastes just like piss. I'm a parasite. I sleep around at night because I'm a member of the nightclub. It's like, and he sells it, and it's so funny, and it's so bitter, and it's musical while being all of those things.
One sad little detail about Terry Hall is that he mentioned as an older man that when he was a child, he was the victim of sex trafficking. He was abducted and taken to France as a 12-year-old and experienced abuse over there, and was very depressed as a teenager. The band sort of gave him a sort of purpose. He wound up singing a song that talked about this in the early 80s.
In the 80s. So yeah, like, I mean, and people my understanding is that at the time the song was understood to be about being abused, like even at that time, even if he hadn't shared too much of the specifics of his own experience. From what I've seen, people were aware that it was somebody doing a song about child sexual abuse who had survived that. I said that, which was huge. And like, I saw people writing about, like, holy fuck, a man actually spoke about that in his experience. How that's insanely brave. The hedge that you dragged me through led to a nervous breakdown. If I could have read what was going on inside your head, I would have said, but I was blind to your devious mind. There's no excuse for child abuse and the scars that it leaves. Where do you draw the line on school trips to France?
The producer of that album said that Terry Hall didn't tell his mother or his school about what happened to him, but then he told the whole world on a record.
Yeah.
And contrast that with, like, you know, this beef that's going on right now with Kendrick Lamar and Drake, where Drake is actually like making fun of an interpretation of a Kendrick Lamar lyric about how he had been molested. And I was just like, Jesus Christ. Oh, I know why you're so obsessed with sexual abuse of children. You were molested as a kid.
What a piece of shit. What a piece of shit.
And how hurtful is that for the fans of your music who have been through an experience like this, hearing him describe that way?
I mean, he's done, right? Like, you don't come back from.
Yeah.
I also, but,
But Terry Hall wasn't settling any scores by admitting this. He didn't even name his abuser. He just said, it happened to me.
Yeah.
Or it happened to the protagonist in the song, which turned out to be a true story.
And then, you know, Terry attempted suicide in this century.
Yeah.
And then came and spoke very publicly about, you know, how he went and he got therapy and how therapy and medication helped him and sort of helped bring together, you know, another tour for the band. And like anytime any artist talks about therapy and medication as helpful for their recovery rather than just putting it to woo-woo, you know, I'm like, that is useful to the world. Like Stevie Nicks will always get credit for me when they were like, how did you get over your fear of flying? And she's like, well, I saw a therapist. And I'm like, thank you for not saying I had a magic crystal that told me that it was okay. Like, because they could. So many of them haven't used to. They'd be like, I just do my spirituality and my meditation. And I'm like, come on, bitch. You're getting medication like the rest of us. And his own stuff was so good. Like, I mean, remember, he's a singer. I don't think he really played anything. Like, I don't know. He wrote these fucking amazing songs. He co-wrote Our Lips Are Sealed for the Go-Go's because he was dating.
It was kind of a collaboration between them.
They met on tour and they were a couple. Our Lips Are, I mean, check out Fun Boy 3's version of Our Lips Are Sealed. It's wonderful. That whole album, that whole Fun Boy 3 album is so good.
You know, we should give some due to Jerry Dammers as well. Well, I always thought of Terry Hall as the guy in the Specials, but in fact, the man behind the scenes was their keyboard player. He never really took a leading role in the band, but he was the guy who started Two Tone Records. And the arrangement that he wound up having with the major label Chrysalis Records, I don't think you could really have an arrangement like this in the modern music industry. There were no formal contracts.
And the contracts that they were putting out with these bands was just like, you can do two solo, you're going to do like two singles with us and then you're free. You don't owe us anything. Unheard of. And he pulled it off. It's amazing.
So Chrysalis Records basically signed Two Tone Records. They didn't sign the Specials.
Yes. Yes. And he got all this artistic freedom and creative freedom. And like, it's never happened before or since, really. I mean, he must have really fucking been able to sell this vision to them to be given the freedom to do that.
The deal they had was that the Chrysalis Records would finance 15 singles and they had the option of releasing 10 of them.
Yes. Yeah.
The bands that put out singles on Two Tone include The Selector, Madness, The Beat, and The Specials especially. Yeah. I think even Elvis Costello recorded a single for Two Tone.
He did. Mm-hmm.
Clearly modeled on Motown, but on a smaller stakes kind of level. But in relation to the audience that it had in the UK, like these songs were massive, massive hits in the UK.
Yeah, Americans have no fucking clue. These were big songs.
Like, I don't know if an American would know the first Specials album as well as I do. I mean, this was an album that wasn't on the radio that much. It was just subculturally so huge. When I was re-listening to their debut record, getting ready for the show, it was like, this is a greatest hits collection. Like,
it does sound like it, doesn't it? Yeah.
It has Gangsters, A Message to You, Rudy, Too Much Too Young, Concrete Jungle, Do the Dog. These are all songs that that everybody I know knows very well. Mm-hmm. And in the UK, they were giant hits. I doubt they charted in the US.
No, they didn't. I mean, partially because promotion was left to Chrysalis for anything outside of England. And I guess there's just something quintessentially British that they just were like, we're not going to even fucking bother to make this penetrable to American listeners. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I immediately was attracted to it, but I've always been into British stuff. I kind of grew up with that as an interest. My first introduction to ska music was definitely listening to a compilation that was like the Two Tone compilation that had all the singles that were put out by all of the Two Tone bands. That was a CD that came out in the 90s. And that's why for me, like the first ska song I heard was One Step Beyond by Madness, which is one hell of an instrumental and just like blew me away. And so in the playlist that I made, the educational playlist that I made for this show, even though Gangsters was the first single to come out and then The Selector was the second, One Step Beyond is always going to be the first song I'll put on my playlist because that was, for whatever reason, the first one on the CD. And in my mind, that's always just like the knock your socks off, blow things away, opening salvo, as it were. Jerry Dammers had an outsized impact on British popular music, on creating like what an independent label or imprint could be. You know, I, after this, like both The Selector and The Beat had their own imprints as well. And, you know, yeah, Two Tone kind of collapsed, but like, I mean, how? He was like touring the world. How was he supposed to have time to like run everything himself? It was so ambitious. But mm-hmm. I have so much respect for him having this plan and making it happen. You know, he mm-hmm. obviously was not someone who people liked working with in the studio. The process of making the final Specials album was so brutal that Rhoda Dakar says she has never listened to the album and would prefer if you didn't ask her about it, in fact.
Yeah, the band started splintering around their second album, More Specials, yeah. which is a lot more experimental. And you had mm-hmm. mentioned that his keyboard was like a lounge music keyboard. Mm-hmm. And that really lounge influence really shows up on the record. Yeah. And I don't know if you have any feelings about one of the strangest songs on that album, Stereotype.
I find it to be a song that I don't really enjoy listening to and will not leave my head. Like, it will not leave my head. So you've just done this to me. I want you to apologize. I'm going to, I don't know why that song doesn't do it for me musically, Stereotype, but he's definitely saying something there.
Yeah. It's all right, but he's wrapped round the lamppost on Saturday night. It's a song that's like, oh yeah, that song. Oh no, now I can't stop thinking about the chord changes.
On it? You're like, I don't really enjoy it, but it's definitely like, it's almost Kinksian in its attempt to try to characterize a kind of person. But then he actually says, but he doesn't really exist.
But you know, they were in a downer mood at this point. I mean, and rightly so. I mean, this was a band that became huge right after Margaret Thatcher was elected prime minister. And so much of what they had to say musically was a rebuke of Thatcher's England.
And but also, like, Jerry really hoped that by creating this form of music, he was going to, like, stop the fascists from attracting young people. And he could see from his own shows that, like, no, that didn't fix the problem. Again, I do think it had a positive social impact. And you will literally hear people say that, like, this helped me have better politics. You know, like, people will say that, so you know it did. But I imagine he also was feeling pretty down from the fact that they were still dealing with fucking National Front douchebags coming to shows and starting fights. And, you know, like, lots of creative people who kind of put together bands, you know, other people from the band wanted to contribute more to the band creatively, and he did not want to hear that from them. He wanted to just do his thing, and he was very much a dictator in the studio, and things sort of ended up with not great blood between people. And, you know, interestingly, Rico, like, again, first wave ska legend, was the person who said, like, I will not do a reunion with you guys if Jerry isn't there. And everybody else was like, and we won't do a reunion if Jerry's there. So, so I don't know, maybe Jerry was more deferential to Rico, or Rico just has thicker skin, but...
This time.
we really do have to talk about Ghost Town, which is like one of the most significant songs of British music in the 80s, maybe even one of the great songs period of the 80s. It's at once of its time. It totally sounds like 1981, and it also sounds timeless to me. Like, it sounds just as great now as it ever has. And what it's about speaks to our world just as much as it did the world of 1981 in Thatcher's England.
Yeah, it was, you know, observations that different members of the band sort of had while doing these tours, looking at, you know, Jerry points to, he saw all these old ladies selling their personal home items in the street, and the band was experiencing too much fighting on the dance floor, like the lyrics said, and they sort of foretelling that soon this town is becoming like a ghost town. Bands won't play no more. And what's so interesting is it's got like this very echo haunting tone. It has like banshees wailing and like singing during the refrain. It's doing so many things and it's so spooky and eerie. And then it has this like little middle eight where the band is making a very up-tempo, almost like flamenco, like Latin flavored bridge. Do you remember the good old days before the ghost town? And it goes right back, you know, we dance and sing and the music played like any boom town. And then it goes right back into how shit's going to hell. And as soon as the song comes out, like there starts to be uprisings around England of underemployed, unemployed young people. And now Neville Staple literally like sings in the song, government's putting the youth on the shelf, which is like literally the thing that people were in the streets protesting about, like immediately after, like that, you know, look, to me, I was like, first hearing that, I'm like, what do they mean the government is putting the youth on the shelf? And then I was like, oh, they're talking about jobs. They're basically angry that the government isn't actually doing anything to help with job creation for young people. And it's so funny because so much of American, it felt so different from what American protest music in America was saying in that moment. But which I think is really cool that they were speaking to a specific situation that they had. There was an amazing podcast that I listened to, but that was put together by the BBC. Alex Weedle, who is a British writer, he had just been arrested during the uprisings when the song, he basically like arrested for like running down the street while being black during the uprisings. And when he was like being arraigned, he like had heard the song played, and he talks about how much that song like fueled him and his like sanity while he was in jail. He was imprisoned with an older Rastafarian man, and they would sing with each other in jail. And, you know, they would, and the guy was like teaching him like, you know, Rastafarian like songs. I'm imagining, you know, a lot of different kinds of Jamaican music. And he was singing Ghost Town, and the guy's like, what is this? And he's like, this is like literally in the charts right now. This is ska in the charts right now. I just love hearing like this, like directly, like, you know, the impacted communities talking about how this song mattered to them in the moment at that time. And it was just really talked about as being like, it was not just, it was the song of the uprising, and it was the song that the news stations were playing to illustrate, to illustrate the uprisings too. So.
And it was a song that was telling the truth about the UK in a time where Thatcher was trying to portray all this as wonderful.
God, yeah. Yeah. One of the things I super respect about the specials is like, you know, God bless Bruce Springsteen and singing the songs of the underclass, but like Bruce doesn't get quite as specific as a lot of these ska songs do. Or if you're listening to even with interviews, like with Jerry, he'll be like, he names his enemies. He's like, Margaret Thatcher did this. And like, he will name his enemies. And I understand that artists have this desire to remain timeless. And there's certainly protest songs that kind of only survive now because they weren't as specific about their issue as they might have been. But there is something with particular utility with the specificity of something like Stand Down Margaret and the specificity of Ghost Town that is missing from people who just, you know, expect that people will understand what they're talking about when they sing Born in the USA. I said, I see no joy, I see only sorrow. I see no chance for your bright new tomorrow. So stand down, Margaret, stand down, please. Stand down, 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 down. Stand down, Margaret, stand down, please. Stand down, 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 down. It was so sad that when Roger just died like a year or so ago. He was 56. He was the baby of the ska movement. He was 15 when he began playing. He's like literally a child and all of those things. And he died at 56. He had brain cancer. And something that Dave pointed out in one of his interviews was that he's like, it has not gone unnoticed to me that all of the black members of my band are dead now. And what does that have to say about healthcare disparities?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, probably says a lot. Thank you, Dave. Like, yeah. Dave is interesting, dude. He like worked for Greenpeace for like several years. He was helping to work on their Greenpeace has historically been an organization that has done a better job of working with artists and pop culture figures than most other nonprofit organizations. And I don't know if Dave is part of how that happened, or if that is why they had Dave in the first place. I don't know about cause and effect, but when I saw that he'd worked at Greenpeace, I was like, yeah, that adds up, because, you know, and the work they were doing was making sure that was having musicians meet with activists to listen to and hear from activists so that musicians weren't just spouting off the top out of their app. Well-intentioned musicians, we should say, weren't just spinning off the top of their heads. There's a great interview with Dave and Mother Jones from like 2008 where he talks about this. But yeah, he was like doing early work on climate change stuff. The co-author of Stand Down Margaret, who would have suspected? The song that went back to, I think it would chart it again when Margaret Thatcher died.
Yeah.
And what a fantastic song. Again, English Beat played that song on a children's TV show in England. And they like stripped off their t-shirts and were wearing like, they stripped off their overshirts and were wearing like anti-nuclear war t-shirts underneath them on the children's TV show to play Stand Up Margaret.
You know, in these terrible times that we're currently living in with all the, you know, revolts and unrest and terrible news coverage, I feel like, you know, it would be great if there was a Ghost Town-like song that spoke to our times instead of Taylor Swift.
God, I know she's so, you know, I mean, there are people, I will tell you, the people making ska music in America today, a lot of it's political, but I just, the way culture is structured, like how do you even make something become zeitgeisty, right?
Yeah.
And something that's really important with protest music is it has to be something which is singable by people in mass. And like, that has to be something which you think about in the creation of a song or else it doesn't work. And the real song that was created as protest music by the Specials, Free Nelson Mandela, like, I super respect how, like, Jerry is saying, like, we wanted the key melody to have, like, three notes so that everybody could just sing it. Because, like, that's what it has to do. And if people can't sing it together, it won't actually have utility in the field. And there's also a history of songs that were not necessarily written to be political being used as political songs. I've seen, like, I Woke Up Like This, I'm Flawless, like the Beyoncé song, used in a protest context by trans women. I was like, yes, in this context, this absolutely means something completely different and very political. But it has to be something that people can do in mass and can do together, or else it's not really useful in a protest setting.
Free Nelson Mandela. I mean, we have to credit
yes,
that
let's
song.
Talk about Free Nelson Mandela. So, you know, I remember that stuff barely. I have an extremely political family, and so like I would have known those things even as a very small child. So this is kind of like where this begins to actually intersect with my life. But Nelson Mandela, you know, was still considered a terrorist by the British government, and the cause of supporting him and fighting apartheid was definitely something that the British left knew about, but it was not like a widely known or understood thing. Jerry Dahmers actually had gone to a music fundraiser for support of, you know, Nelson Mandela. And kind of, before he'd went to the music fundraiser, he kind of knew that this was like something he should support, but he just didn't really know anything substantive about it. And the more he learned, the more horrified he was. And he's like, I am going to make a song to help more people know about this.
This was an incarnation of the Specials after Terry Hall and the other guys had left.
Yes. I mean, when Terry Hall and the other two vocalists of the band left, yeah, like when your band loses all three vocalists, you know, you have to really find some new solutions. But anyway, Stan Campbell, who had begun singing some of the songs on the new album, along with Rhoda Dekar from the Body Snatchers, like brings him in to sing lead on this and develops this like very African, South African music driven single that sounds nothing like anything else the Specials have done. I remember the first time I actually heard the song on the album, I was like, this sounds nothing like anything else on the album. But he's drawing on African and specifically South African music, as well as some Latin music influences. This is the story of Nelson Mandela. Are you so blind? Can you not see? And he's calling, and of course it's just Free Nelson Mandela. And it's so easy that anyone can sing along with it. And it has multiple, you know, black men and women's voices singing on the track together. Elvis Costello produced it because at that point, everybody was so frustrated with the Jerry. Jerry knew that he wouldn't be able to crank it out fast enough if he was in charge of it in the studio. So he was like, Elvis, please help me make sure that this thing that is, it's too important for my ego to like get in the way of this happening. Help me make this happen. And they put the song out. And what's amazing is before the Nelson Mandela concert that then was organized around the song was held, most British people did not know who Nelson Mandela was, and most of them did not support his release after the concert that Jerry organized. 77% of Britons knew who Mandela was, and 70% said he should be released. Like, you can literally A-B test the impact that this song had in the public's understanding of Nelson Mandela. Like, yeah. And somebody could say like, well, I don't think the British popular opinion on Nelson Mandela really mattered in terms of liberating him or not. But I'm like, are you sure? Because England and South Africa kind of have a lot going on with each other. I'm sure this is not the most important factor by any stretch of the imagination, but this is clearly a real impact. And Nelson Mandela, apparently, so the song was obviously banned in South Africa. Apparently people in the townships were singing it in the streets.
You know, what I thought of a lot when I was listening to the Specials getting ready for this show was that famous quote attributed to Emma Goldman about, if I can't dance, I don't mm-hmm. want to be a part of your revolution. Mm-hmm. Like that, this is all, you know, one of the reasons why you these movements win is because of positivity and strength in numbers and, you know, joy in the act, you know, and Free Nelson Mandela is a very joyous song.
Yeah, it so is. It just really brings people along with you. And when he was released, he went to England and there was a party, another concert party that was organized by Jerry and co-organized with some bigger acts at that point. And, you know, there's a photo of Nelson Mandela and Jerry Dahmers together, which is like really cool.
Jerry Dahmers, who was missing his front teeth from a bar fight that he got into that he never had fixed.
but and I should say, like, the story he tells around that has changed at times.
Okay.
But yes, bar fight is one of the popular stories of it. We Americans have ideas about the British dental system. and my understanding from things is that this was a choice that Jerry had, that he was like, badge of honor, mm-hmm. I am going to...
even if we're famous, I'm going to be missing my two front teeth.
Yeah. And he was going to be like, he's such a fascinating guy. You know, one of the things that, interview with, I want to say Horace. Horace from the Specials is the bass player who became interesting. Horace worked as an art teacher for special needs kids for like 10 years after the band broke up. Horace said that when he met Jerry in college, in art school, everybody was just still dressing like a hippie, including himself. And Jerry was dressed with like a shag haircut. And like he was in the Faces, but like not the small Faces, the Faces, like, you know, the Rod Stewart version of the Faces. And he stood out visually, you know, even in that moment. And something else that Horace told me that just maybe my drop on the floor, he said that he thinks that the Black members of the Specials were the first Black people he'd had a real conversation with ever. And I'm just like, you can't tell that my jaw is on the floor, but just pretend my jaw is on the floor. How wild is that, right?
This is music that was right on time in the UK and well ahead of its time in America. Like it had a delayed—
And you could dance to it.
Yeah. But it had a delayed effect. People found out about it in retrospect because of the success of the third wave of ska, which was the more commercial sellout kind of bands. You may like that stuff more than I do just because you listened to it as a teenager, you know, but you worked your way back. Just the way that I found out about the Specials just through subcultures of my teenage years and then discovered the first wave of ska, which I loved. And, you know, the Trojan Story sets are like gold to me.
Well, I don't know why you know, I got to see like the Pie Tasters and the Toasters and stuff like that. I saw the Scatolites play, which first wave would, I imagine they probably had more original members playing in the 90s than they do when they play now. But I don't know for sure why the 80s stuff spoke more to me than the 90s. But I will say that there was a ska scene in America that was an underground scene that existed for years before the kind of corny bands that we don't really like kind of broke through, like, as this is true for many things as well, was the popularity of Dance Craze, the music documentary that actually did tour America, and that helped build interest in the genre. But it was the kind of thing that, like, you know, alternative undergroundy people knew. Like, it was not, you know, most of these things only got play on college radio, basically.
Dance Craze is definitely worth catching up to. It's been recently restored. It's kind of like the last waltz for Two Tone Records.
Yes, that's a great description. And you know, you can't get it in the U.S. still, but you will eventually be able to. Did you know that REM opened for The Beat?
No,
when they were playing in England. Yes, and they all talked about musical payment structures and like how to handle payments and stuff like that. And The Beat shared everything equally financially. And REM, you know, did that as well. Like, that was like a model that they kind of copied from there.
Mm-hmm.
And The Beat had like a million fucking members, I mean, relative to REM even. But that's interesting to me to sort of see that moment in time where you would have had that happen.
Well, to see the bands at their peak as well, and also to see the scene. This crumbling sort of music hall that can hold 2,000 people with the cameras often on stage with the band during their performances. Mm-hmm. You don't often see coverage like that.
And the audience often on stage with the band. Like, it became kind of overwhelming. You know, the artists will say, like, eventually it kind of became a problem. But it used to be that, like, the fans would all get on stage near the end of the sets. And you would see like Jerry like standing on his keyboard while playing his keyboard so that there'd be more room for more bodies on the stage. And like Neville Staple is like practically like flying across people's hands. He's an amazing live sort of presence and physical performer, just like superhuman. Like, he's just amazing, his energy that he has, and he's like dancing across people's hands and across the speakers, and the contrast between him and Terry could not be more dramatic, and I love that, right? That's like one of the things that makes it so great. But it's interesting, like, watching the bands live. One of the things that I really came to during this was Bad Manners had always been the band that I'd been least interested in because they kind of presented themselves as very joking and very, like, did a lot of clowning and sort of buffoonishness as part of their performance. I did not realize how good they were as instrumentalists. Like, if you listen to their live songs from Dance Craze, one of them is a little bit weak, but every other live song they have, I'm like, these guys are really fucking good at their instruments. They are good. And their musicianship was just so astonishingly strong. I had no idea, because they're just sort of like, oh yeah, they're very zany. And then when you see them perform, also, like, the amount of energy that Buster Bloodvessel, yes, that's his stage name, Buster Bloodvessel, is putting out, you're just like, that is a crazy amount of energy. Like, the it's like, it's so alive. So this kind of gave me a new appreciation for them as a band.
The film also gives a fair amount of screen time to the women-led bands too.
Yes, they really do. Now, my only critique for the band, for the film really, was that it seemed to almost studiously avoid showing either of the immensely important middle-aged men,
yes,
who were playing with them. I'm like, guys, they're kind of a big deal. Saxa, like, is like a legend.
I know. I noticed that when they covered him playing the sax solo, they cut him off so you couldn't see him playing the instrument, because they wanted to hide the fact that he's like a guy in his early 50s or something.
I know. It's so sad, because it's like the band thought it was so fucking cool that he was with them. You know, I don't know why they assumed the fans wouldn't think it was cool. Maybe, you know, the fans, you know, don't know who he is, but they might be like, huh, okay. Because seriously, like, the audiences are so young. The audiences are like children. And somebody also was saying that Madness were particularly popular with literal school age children.
Yes.
Probably because of their sense of humor and their interest in wordplay. Mm-hmm. That was like a very accessible kind of humor for them.
And their ridiculous skanky walk, where they would all line up with each other and start walking.
They're very comical. I do want to give Madness their due on a couple fronts, including, like, I mean, they have some political songs themselves, including like Embarrassment, which is basically about white parents being angry at their daughter for being pregnant with a black man, and like expressing all of their, like, you're an embarrassment, how are we supposed to be seen in public? I mean, like, that's an extremely serious topic to cover in a song. And then they're just so driven by these excellent saxophone solos. Like, and actually, interesting, the lyrics for Embarrassment were written by the sax player, because it was based on his own experience of his parents dealing with his sister. So anyway, but yeah, like, their saxophonist is fabulous. And I, you know, so many of these bands, they were really in a pressure cooker, or a crucible. That is the word I want. They were in a crucible, and they came out being able to do tremendously well live. And the touring schedules that everybody had was insane. So, of course, everybody lost their minds and drove each other crazy. And, like, no one should have to function like that. but they, you could just see some amazing high energy, super freaking tight performances. And I can see how, you know, for American kids who learned how to play brass instruments to be in marching band, like, the notion that you could be in a fucking cool band playing your brass instrument.
Yeah.
It's just, holy fuck, whole new worlds open to you then. I don't know. It's that I worry that there aren't people who know how to play instruments anymore. And I just watched the Rude Boy document, the Trojan Records documentary called Rude Boy, the Story of Trojan Records. And there's a moment where you hear Ken Booth, you know, original first wave artist, sing, and he's like in his 80s. And I was struck. I'm like, Ken Booth sounds like this in his 80s? Good God. So I went and I Googled him, and I'm like, I wanted to see, like, what's he doing now? Well, Ken Booth is still putting out albums in his 80s. But when I saw him play a show, like, all the artists backing him up were all of these sort of like middle-aged white guys. And I felt a little bit like, oh, I guess nobody knows how to play instruments anymore. I don't, I felt sad. And I, you know, especially given how much brass costs, how, to me at least, brass always feels like, I've never tried to play brass, because if I can't sing while I'm doing it, I don't think I could handle it. But like, it just seems really hard. And like, I can't even imagine, like who's going to do that? And, you know, in the US, we've defunded arts education entirely. It's one of the reasons why the pop charts are completely comprised by music written by people in Sweden, where they actually have an arts education, a music education program in their schools. My brother worked with a ton of Swedish pop artists and has spoken with them at length. and can tell you all about the excellent music education in public schools in Sweden. And like, that is not happening here. And how do you even get your hands on, you know, instruments to play or practice things? It makes me really sad. I have accepted because the world has shown me this, that rock music is essentially a dead form in the same way that jazz is. Like, there will continue to be new rock albums created, and some of those albums will be really good, and people will still go to see those bands, and people will still enjoy them. But it is no longer a zeitgeist form of music in a significant way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can acknowledge that, you know, that happens to everything eventually. People recently were saying the same of hip hop, and that really made my jaw hit the floor. And I'm like, oh my God, you might be true. That might be true. Ah. I'm also probably to blame because I still mostly listen to Wu-Tang. But like, there's something that's lost when you have removing any aspect of the physical creation of the piece. And, you know, it's not like I'm against using like a good drum, you know, drum machine has its, everything has its place, but I want the human hand in it somewhere. And I just, you know, playing music is literally good for your body. I mean, playing music will also fuck up your body, but playing music is also good for you on an emotional and psychological, spiritual level. Like, I want people to feel like the freedom and comfort of being able to sing in public, to express themselves, to sing along with things and to create, you know? There's the wonderful documentary that we're going to link to that Arena TV did at the time in the 80s about the beginnings of the ska scene. Like, they sent a cub reporter out to Coventry to cover this new genre. And it's just amazing seeing these young artists doing their very first, you know, on-camera interviews. And you could see how uncomfortable almost everybody is, but not everybody, the kind of questions they ask. And it's an excellent, it's a really well-done documentary. But one of the things that I love is this quote from Pauline Black, who says, "We're a dance band. Well, we're not just a dance band. We have things to say as well." And that just to me is like a great summation of what Two Tone was about. They're a dance band, but they're not just a dance band.
Yeah, they're a political band, but it's that sort of spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down mm-hmm. approach, where you can enjoy yourself while you're hearing a new perspective on something, mm-hmm. or setting people straight, like, you know, impressionable young minds hearing in a really cool way that it's kind of a waste of your life to be a racist or to be a drunk, you know?
Yeah, totally. Oh my God. There's two ska songs that at least two ska songs about how you should wear a condom.
Yeah.
And like, this is, you know, like really in the very beginning of the dawning of the time when anybody would even talk about that as a subject. We mentioned Racist Friend by The Specials. Like, if you have a racist friend, now is the time for that friendship to end. That's Rhoda Dakar singing lead vocals on that mm-hmm. one. And it's really a provocation, saying like, think about this. I remember the first time I heard that song, I was like, why do they even need to tell you this? And now as an adult, I'm like, I know why they need to tell you this.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, and Jerry has even said like, it's a provocation, not like a prescription really, but he wants people to ask themselves, like, what are they going to do about the racists in their life? And also he says, and if you are a racist, don't pretend to be my friend. And this is like after, you know, this band has been dealing with National Front kids going to their shows and starting fights nonetheless. So, you know, it is really a powerful piece of advice, not unlike Rudy, a message to you.
Yes.
If you only know the second, the UK ska versions of some of these original songs, go check out the originals. They're really interesting, really wonderful music in their own right too.
You're growing older each day. You want to think of your future. Or you might wind up in jail, then you will suffer. Ah, Rudy, a message to you, Rudy, a message.
Ilana, thank you so much for joining me. This was a long developing idea that we had, and I'm glad that we finally yes. did it.
Yes.
And obviously, RIP to your friend Steven. I was wondering if you could tell my listeners a little bit about him.
Oh, sure. my very close friend and frequent podcasting partner on Graphic Policy Radio, who, if you've listened to my podcast, you've probably heard, Stephen Atwell, died early in April. He was a historian. He was a union activist. His historian focus was on post-Reconstruction and then American job creation programs. But he also was like kind of the world's leading expert on A Song of Ice and Fire and a huge expert on Marvel Comics. So he's bringing all of these different kinds of knowledge together and like reading it through with like a labor history lens, and truly just a brilliant person and a kind person and so patient with everybody else who knows so much less than him, which is pretty much everybody. I've been in the process of trying to, because he and I have been podcasting together for so long, the audio quality of some of our early episodes together was not up to my current standards. So I've been up to going through the archives and trying to get the audio cleaned up of some of our earlier work, because I don't want the audio quality to get in the way of people's ability to appreciate the words he had to say. It's Stephen Atwell, Atwell, and Stephen with a V, and regular on Graphic Policy. He had his own podcast for a while with Scott Eric Kaufman on Game of Thrones stuff, and Scott himself also died from cancer a number of years ago. A real loss to the world of leftist people who think that popular culture is an important subject for study. So thanks for letting me share that.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah. And what are you up to, and where can people find you these days on social media? I try to spend more time on Blue Sky than on Twitter.
Oh, you do? Yes. I spend a lot of time on Blue Sky, where my handle is my last name, Levin. I am still on the other place because of the nature of my work, but I try not to spend my social time there. But on the other place, I am still Elana_Brooklyn. Graphic Policy Radio, we are talking about popular culture, generally speaking, looking at comics and comics adjacent media, but as read through the lens of being leftists, queer feminists, and labor activists. And we also host a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast series called Deep Space Dive that I know a lot of folks who are not necessarily comics fans have been known to enjoy, the Deep Space Dive. But I want to thank you because, while my own podcast does have a broad range of topics, I really don't do music deep dives. And so it's been such a great pleasure to be able to share and talk with you and your audience about, the music that I love that everyone thinks is stupid because they're wrong.
So. Even when we were sort of doing this show, I was saying, I was making ska jokes and, I tease, and it's mostly because of teasing the kinds of people who love ska. So many meatheads in my life are big ska fans and stuff. But, the music, of course, is innocent and important and underrated, and it's a subject that I turn to you to find my way into, and to direct the listeners from a real enthusiast's perspective on it, instead of just
thank you.
Your playlist is great, and I'll put a link to that in the show description as well. But
thank you so much.
But this is really important music that deserves more respect.
And I should also point out to people that swing revival has nothing to do with ska revival. Those are from completely different decades. You're just confused because they have horns.
Yeah, this was from our DMs. When I was trying to explain what it is that bugs me about ska, I was mentioning swing dancing, and Ilana
was like,
no.
It's a completely different decade, but because both of these things became the revivals of such became popular in close proximity to each other, although third wave definitely hit before swing revival did for like many years, but it does sort of get conflated together, but nope, not the same. Anyway, had to add that. Thank you again. This is always a pleasure. Thank you for the amazing show that you do. I always enjoy listening to. So
Before we go, just a reminder that we do have a Patreon, and patrons get access to bonus episodes every month. There are dozens of past episodes that you can catch up on. If you go to patreon.com/junkfilter, it's only $5 a month. We'll have another episode of Junk Filter in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken, and thank you for listening.
Be it your sister, be it your brother.